Chapter 1. The Cat at the Threshold. Pet cats are now a global phenomenon, but how they transform themselves from wild to domestic is still a mystery. Most of the animals around us were domesticated for prosaic, practical reasons. Cows, sheep, and goats provide meat, milk, and hides. Pigs provide meat. Chickens, meat, and eggs. Dogs, our second favorite pet, continue to provide humans with many benefits beside companionship. Help with hunting, herding, guarding, tracking and trailing, to name but a few. Cats are not nearly as useful as any of these. Even their traditional reputation as rodent controllers may be somewhat exaggerated, even though, historically, this was their obvious function as far as humankind was concerned. Therefore, in contrast to the dog, we have no easy answers as to how the cat has insinuated itself so effectively into human culture. Our search for explanation starts some 10 millennia ago, when cats probably first arrived at our doorsteps. Conventional accounts of the domestication of the cat, based on archaeological and historical records, propose that they first lived in human homes in Egypt about 3,500 years ago. This theory, however, has recently been challenged by new evidence coming from the field of molecular biology. Examination of differences between the DNA of today's domestic and wild cats has dated their origins much earlier, anywhere between 10,000 and 15,000 years ago, 8,000 and 13,000 years BCE. We can safely discount the earliest date in this range. Anything earlier than about 15,000 years ago makes little sense in terms of the evolution of our own species, since it is unlikely that Stone Age hunter-gatherers would have had the need or resources to keep cats. The minimum estimate, 10,000 years, presumes that domestic cats are derived from several wild ancestors that came from several different locations in the Middle East. In other words, the domestication of the cat happened in several widely separated places, either roughly contemporaneously or over a longer period of time. Even if we assume that cats started to become domesticated around 8,000 years BCE, this leaves us with a 6,500-year interval before the first historical records of domestic cats appear in Egypt. So far, few scientists of any kind have studied this first and longest phase in the partnership between human and cat. The archaeological record for this period, such as it is not very illuminating. Cats' teeth and fragments of bones dating between 7,000 and 6,000 BCE have been excavated around the Palestinian city of Jericho and elsewhere in the Fertile Crescent, the cradle of civilization that extends from Iraq through Jordan and Syria to the eastern shores of the Mediterranean and Egypt. However, these fragments are uncommon. Moreover, they could well have come from wild cats, perhaps killed for their pelts. Rock paintings and statuettes of cat-like animals from the following millennia, discovered in what is now Israel and Jordan, could conceivably depict domesticated cats. However, these cats are not depicted in domestic settings, so they may well be representations of wild cats, possibly even big cats. Yet even if we assume that these pieces of evidence all refer to early forms of the domestic cat, their very rarity still must be explained. By 8,000 BCE, humankind's relationship with the domestic dog had already progressed to the extent that dogs were routinely buried alongside their masters in several parts of Asia, Europe, and North America, whereas burials of cats first became common in Egypt around 1000 BCE. If cats were indeed domesticated pets during this time, we should have far more tangible evidence of that relationship than has been uncovered. Our best clues on how the partnership between man and cat began come not from the Fertile Crescent, but instead from Cyprus. Cyprus is one of the few Mediterranean islands that have never been joined to the mainland, even when that sea was at its lowest level. Consequently, its animal population has had to migrate there by flying or swimming. That is, until humans started to travel there in primitive boats some 12,000 years ago. At that point, the eastern Mediterranean had no domesticated animals, with the likely exception of some early dogs, so the animals that made the crossing with those first human settlers must have been either individually tamed wild animals or inadvertent hitchhikers. Therefore, while we cannot possibly tell whether ancient remains of cats on the mainland are from wild, tame, or domesticated animals, cats could clearly have reached Cyprus only by being deliberately transported there by humans, assuming, as we safely should, that cats of that era were as averse to swimming in the ocean as today's cats are. Any remains of cats found there must be those of semi-domesticated or at least captive animals, or their descendants. On Cyprus, the earliest remains of cats coincide with and are found within the first permanent human settlements some 7,500 years BCE, making it highly likely that they were deliberately transported there. Cats are too large and conspicuous to have been accidentally transported across the Mediterranean in the small boats of the time. We know very little about seagoing boats from that period, but they were likely too small to conceal a stowaway cat. Moreover, we have no evidence for cats living away from human habitations on Cyprus for another 3,000 years. The most likely scenario, then, is that the earliest settlers of Cyprus brought with them wild cats that they had captured and tamed on the mainland. It is implausible that they were the only people to have thought of taming wild cats, so capturing cats and taming them was likely already an established practice in the eastern Mediterranean. Confirming this, we also have evidence for prehistoric importations of tamed cats to other large Mediterranean islands, such as Crete, Sardinia, and Majorca. The most likely reason for taming wild cats is also evident from the first settlements on Cyprus. Right from the outset, these habitations, like their counterparts of the time on the mainland, became infested by house mice. Presumably these unwanted mice were stowaways, accidentally transported across the Mediterranean in sacks of food or seed corn. The most likely scenario, therefore, is that as soon as mice became established on Cyprus, the colonizers imported tame or semi-domesticated cats to keep them under control. This might have been 10 years or 100 years after the first settlements were established. The archaeological record does not reveal such small differences. If this is correct, it suggests that the practice of taming cats to control mice was already entrenched on the mainland as long as 10,000 years ago. No firm evidence for this is ever likely to be found because the ubiquitous presence of wild cats there makes it impossible to tell whether the remains of a cat, even if found within a settlement, are those of a truly wild cat that had died or been killed when hunting there, or of a cat that had lived there for most or all of its life. Whatever its exact origins, the tradition of taming wild cats to control vermin was well established by modern times, in parts of Africa where domestic cats are scarce and wild cats easy to obtain. While traveling the White Nile in 1869, the German botanist explorer Georg Schweinfurt found that his boxes of botanical specimens were being invaded by rodents during the night. He recalled, "One of the commonest animals hereabouts was the wild cat of the steppes. Although the natives do not breed them as domestic animals, yet they catch them separately when they are quite young, and find no difficulty in reconciling them to a life about their huts and enclosures, where they grow up and wage their natural warfare against the rats. I procured several of these cats, which, after they had been kept tied up for several days, seemed to lose a considerable measure of their ferocity and to adapt themselves to an indoor existence, so as to approach in many ways to the habits of the common cat. By night I attached them to my parcels, which were otherwise in jeopardy, and by this means I could go to bed without further fear of any depredations from the rats." Like Schweinfurt, those much earlier explorers who first brought wild cats to Cyprus would almost certainly have found that they had to keep the cats tethered. If allowed to run free, the cats would have quickly escaped and wreaked havoc on the native fauna, which up to that point would have had no experience with a predator as formidable as a cat. We know that this is what eventually happened. Several centuries after human settlement, cats, indistinguishable from wildcats, spread throughout Cyprus and remained there for several thousand years. Footnote: these cats are now extinct on Cyprus, displaced by the red fox, another introduction, which is now the only land-based carnivorous mammal on the island. End of note. Most likely, only the cats that were confined to the grain stores would have stayed there to help the early settlers to rid those stores of pests. The others would have left to exploit the local wildlife. The descendants of these escapees may have been captured and even eaten from time to time, since broken cat bones have been found at several other Neolithic sites on Cyprus, as well as those of other predators, such as foxes and even domestic dogs. The practice of taming wildcats to control vermin was probably prompted by the emergence of a new pest in the early granaries, the house mouse, Mus musculus. Indeed, the histories of these two animals are inextricably interwoven. The house mouse is one of more than 30 species of mouse found worldwide, but the only one that has adapted to living alongside humans and exploiting our food. House mice have their origins in a wild species from somewhere in northern India that was in existence possibly as long as a million years ago, certainly well before the evolution of humankind. From there they spread both east and west, feeding on wild grains, until some reached the Fertile Crescent, where they eventually encountered the earliest stores of harvested grain. Mouse teeth have been found among stored grain dating back 11,000 years in Israel, and a 9,500-year-old stone pendant carved in the shape of a mouse's head was found in Syria. Thus began an association with humankind that continues to the present day. Humans not only provided an abundance of food that mice could exploit, but our buildings also provided both warm, dry places to build nests and protection from predators such as wildcats. Mice that could adapt to these living conditions thrived, while those that could not died out. Today's house mice rarely breed successfully away from human habitation, especially where there are wild competitors, such as wood mice. Humans also provided house mice with a way to colonize new areas. Mice from the southeastern part of the Fertile Crescent, what is now Syria and northern Iraq, were accidentally transported, presumably in grain being traded between communities, throughout the Near East, up to the eastern shores of the Mediterranean, and then to nearby islands such as Cyprus. The first culture to be bedeviled by house mice was that of the Natufians, who by extension are the people most likely to have initiated the cat's long journey into our homes. The Natufians inhabited the area that now comprises Israel-Palestine, Jordan, southwestern Syria, and southern Lebanon, from about 11,000 to 8,000 BCE. Widely regarded as the inventors of agriculture, they were initially hunter-gatherers, like other inhabitants of the region. Soon, however, they began to specialize in harvesting the wild cereals that grew abundantly all around them, in a region that was significantly more productive then than it is today. To do this, the Natufians invented the sickle. Sickle blades found at Natufian settlements still show the glossy surfaces that could have been produced only from scything through the abrasive stems of wild grains, wheat, barley, and rye. The early Natufians lived in small villages. Their houses were partly below ground, partly above, with walls and floors of stone and brushwood roofs. Until about 10,800 BCE, they rarely planted cereals deliberately, but over the next 1,300 years, a rapid change in climate known as the Younger Dryas brought about a significant intensification in field clearing, planting, and cultivation. As the amounts of harvested grain increased, so did the need for storage. The Natufians and their successors probably used storage pits built out of mud brick and constructed like miniature versions of their houses. It was probably this invention that triggered the self-domestication of the house mouse, which, moving into this rich and novel environment, thereby became humankind's first mammalian pest species. As the numbers of mice grew, they must have attracted the attentions of their natural predators, including foxes, jackals, birds of prey, the Natufians' domestic dogs, and, of course, wildcats. Wildcats had two advantages that set them apart from other predators of mice. They were both agile and nocturnal, well adapted to hunting in the near darkness when the mice became active. However, if these wildcats had been as frightened of man as their modern counterparts are, it is difficult to imagine how they would have exploited this new rich source of food. Almost certainly, therefore, the wildcats in the region inhabited by the Natufians were less wary than those of today. We have no evidence that the Natufians deliberately domesticated the cat. Like the mouse before it, the cat simply arrived to exploit a new resource that had been created by the beginnings of agriculture. As Natufian agriculture became more complex, involving both an increasing array of crops and the domestication of animals such as sheep and goats, and as agriculture extended to other regions and cultures, so the opportunities available for cats multiplied. These were not pet cats as we know them today. Rather, the cats that exploited these concentrations of mice would have been more like today's urban foxes, capable of adapting to a human environment but still retaining their essential wildness. Domestication was to come much later. We know surprisingly little about the wild cats of the Fertile Crescent and surrounding areas. Listen to the section, The Evolution of the Cats, at the end of this chapter. The archaeological record indicates that 10,000 years ago, several species lived in the region, all of which would have been attracted by concentrations of mice. We know that later on, the ancient Egyptians kept tame jungle cats, Felis caus, in considerable numbers. Jungle cats, though, are substantially heavier than wild cats, weighing between 10 and 20 pounds, and large enough to kill young gazelle and cheetle. Although their normal diet includes rodents, they may have been too obtrusive to get regular access to granaries. Alternatively, they may simply have been temperamentally unsuited to living alongside man. We do have evidence that the Egyptians tried to tame and even train them as rodent controllers, but apparently without any lasting success. Coeval with them were sand cats, Felis margarita, large-eared nocturnal animals that hunt by night using their acute hearing. They are, moreover, comparatively unafraid of humans, and hence might be thought good candidates for taming and domestication. However, they are made for life in deserts. The pads on their feet are covered in thick fur to protect them from the hot sand, so few would have found themselves near the first stores of grains. The Natufians generally built their villages in wooded areas. As civilization spread eastward through Asia, so it would have come into contact with other cat species. Achanudaru, a town built by the Harappan civilization close to the Indus River in what is now Pakistan, archaeologists found a 5,000-year-old mud brick imprinted with a cat's foot, overlapped by that of a dog. As the newly made brick was drying in the sun, the cat appears to have run across it, closely followed by a dog, possibly in hot pursuit. The footprint is larger than that of a domestic cat, and its webbed feet and extended claws identify it as a fishing cat, Felis viverrina, found today from the Indus Basin eastward and south to Sumatra in Indonesia, though not in the Fertile Crescent. As its name implies, the fishing cat is a strong swimmer and specializes in catching fish and aquatic birds. Although it will also take small rodents, it is difficult to see how it would switch to a diet consisting predominantly of mice, so it too is an unlikely candidate for domestication. Farther afield, we know of at least two other species of cat that came in out of the wild to prey on the vermin that plagued humankind's food stores. In Central Asia and ancient China, the local wild cat, the Manul or Pallas's cat, named after the German naturalist who first categorized it, was occasionally even tamed and deliberately kept as a rodent controller. The Manul has the shaggiest coat of any member of the cat family, so long that its hair almost completely obscures its ears. In pre-Columbian Central America, meanwhile, an otter-like cat, the Jaguarundi, was probably also kept as a semi-tame pest controller. None of these species have ever become fully domesticated. Neither are any of them included in the direct ancestry of today's house cats. Out of all these various wild cats, only one was successfully domesticated. This honor goes to the Arabian wildcat Felis silvestris libica, as confirmed by their DNA. Footnote. The spelling libica, L-Y-B-I-C-A, should more correctly be L-I-B-Y-C-A, from Libya, but most modern accounts use the original, incorrect version. End of note. In the past, both scientists and cat fanciers have suggested that certain breeds within the domestic cat families are hybrids with other species. For example, the Persian's fluffy feet are superficially similar to the sand cat's, and its fine coat is somewhat like that of a manul. However, the DNA of all domestic cats, random bred, Siamese or Persian, shows no trace of these other species, or indeed any other admixture. Somehow the Arabian wild cat alone was able to inveigle itself into human society, outcompeting all its rivals, and eventually spreading throughout the world. Although the qualities that gave it this edge are not easy to pin down, they probably occurred in combination only in the wildcats of the Middle East. The wildcat Felis silvestris is currently found throughout Europe, Africa, and Central Asia, as well as Western Asia, the area where it probably first evolved. Like many predators, such as the wolf, it is now found only in isolated and generally remote areas where it can avoid persecution from man. This has not always been the case. 5,000 years ago, wild cats were evidently regarded as delicacies in some areas. The rubbish pits left by the lake dwellers of Germany and Switzerland contain many wild cat bones. Footnote. These lake dwellers built villages on sites that now lie beneath the margins of lakes, but were probably fertile dry land at the time. End of note. The cats must have been abundant at the time, otherwise they could hardly have been trapped in such large numbers. Over the centuries they became less common, displaced by the felling of their forest habitat for agriculture, and forced farther into the woods by development and loss of habitat. The invention of firearms led to wild cats being hunted to extinction in many areas. During the 19th century, various European countries, including the UK, Germany and Switzerland, classified them as vermin, due to the harm they supposedly caused both wildlife and livestock. Footnote. Francis Pitt claimed that the Scottish wildcat would have joined its English and Welsh counterparts in extinction had it not been for the call-up of the younger gamekeepers to fight in the Great War. End of note. Only recently, due to the establishment of wildlife reserves and a more informed attitude to the important role that predators play in stabilizing ecosystems, are wildcats returning to areas such as Bavaria, where they have not been seen for hundreds of years. The wildcat is now divided into four subspecies or races. These are the European forest cat, Felis silvestris silvestris, the Arabian wildcat, Felis silvestris libica, the Southern African wildcat, Felis silvestris caffra, and the Indian desert cat, Felis silvestris ornata. All these cats are rather similar in appearance, and all are capable of interbreeding where their ranges overlap. A possible fifth subspecies is the very rare Chinese desert cat, Felis bietai, which according to its DNA split off from the main wildcat lineage about a quarter of a million years ago. It's possible that these cats actually form a separate species, as no hybrids are known to exist, but they live in such a small and inaccessible region, part of the Chinese province of Sichuan, that this may be due to lack of opportunity rather than physical impossibility. Wildcats from different parts of the world differ markedly in how easily they can be tamed. Domestication, moreover, can start only with animals that are already tame enough to raise their young in the proximity of people. Those offspring that are best suited to the company of humans and human environments are, perhaps unsurprisingly, more likely to stay and breed there than those that are not. The latter will most likely revert to the wild. Over several generations, this repeated natural selection will, even on its own, gradually change the genetic makeup of these animals so that they become better adapted to life alongside people. It is also likely that, at the same time, humans will intensify that selection by feeding the more docile animals and driving away those prone to bite and scratch. This process cannot start without some genetic basis for tameness existing beforehand, and in the case of wildcats, this is far from evenly distributed. Today, some parts of the world have little raw material for domestication, while others seem more promising. We know, for example, that the four subspecies of wildcat differ in how easy they are to tame. The European forest cat is larger and thicker set than a typical domestic cat, and has a characteristic short tail with a blunt black tip. This aside, it looks from a distance much like a domestic striped tabby. A distant glimpse is all that most people are likely ever to get, however, for it is among the wildest of animals. This is largely due to its genetics and not the way it is treated. Those few people who have tried to produce tame forest cats have met with precious little but rejection. In 1936, natural and wildlife photographer Francis Pitt wrote, "It has long been stated that the European wildcat is untamable. There was a time when I did not believe this. My optimism was daunted when I made the acquaintance with Beelzebina, Princess of Devils. She came from the highlands of Scotland, a half-grown kitten that spat and scratched in fiercest resentment. Her pale green eyes glared savage hatred at human beings, and all attempts to establish friendly relations with her failed. She grew less afraid, but as her timidity departed, her savagery increased." Pitt then went on to obtain an even younger male kitten in the hope that Beelzebina had been too old to be socialized when first found. That she named this new kitten Satan perhaps suggests how difficult he was to handle from the outset. As he grew stronger and more confident, he became impossible to touch. He would take food from the hand, but would spit and growl while doing so, and then quickly back away. However, he was not pathologically aggressive. He just hated people. While he was still young, Pitt introduced him to a female domestic kitten, Beauty, toward whom he was all gentleness and devotion. When she was let out of the cage in which she had to be kept, this distressed him sorely. He rent the air with harsh cries, for his voice, though loud, was not lovely. Beauty and Satan produced several litters of kittens, all of which had the characteristic appearance of forest cats. Some, despite being handled from an early age, grew to be as savage as their father. Others were more sociable toward Pitt and her parents, though all remained very wary of unfamiliar people. Pitt's experiences of Scottish wildcats seemed to be typical. Mike Tomkes, the wilderness man, was also unable to socialize his two hand-raised wildcat sisters, Cleo and Patra, which he kept at his remote cottage on the shores of a Scottish loch. We know little about the Indian desert cat, but it is reputedly difficult to tame. This subspecies is found to the south and east of the Caspian Sea, southward through Pakistan, and into the northwestern Indian states of Gujarat, Rajasthan and the Punjab, and eastward through Kazakhstan into Mongolia. Its coat is usually paler than that of the other wild cats, and is blotchy rather than tabby in pattern. Like other wild cats, it will occasionally base itself near farms, attracted by the concentration of rodents, but it has never taken the next step to domestication, acceptance of humans. We have records from Harappa of tamed caracals, a medium-sized, long-limbed cat with characteristic tufted ears, and jungle cats, to add to the fishing cat that left its footprint there. but we find no indications of any Indian desert cats. For a long time, biologists and cat fanciers alike thought that Siamese cats could be a mixture of domestic and Indian desert cat, the progeny of interbreeding between early domestic cats and local wild cats somewhere around the Indus Valley. However, scientists have not found the characteristic DNA signature of the Indian desert cat in any examples of the Siamese and related breeds, which instead are ultimately derived from the wildcats of the Middle East or Egypt. There are no Sylvestris wildcats in Southeast Asia, so Siamese cats must have been imported from the West as fully domesticated animals. The wildcats of South Africa and Namibia, Kafri cats, are likewise genetically distinctive. They migrated south from the original wildcat population in northern Africa about 175,000 years ago, around the same time as the ancestors of the Indian desert cat migrated east. It is unclear where the boundary between the southern African and Arabian wildcats lies. No wildcat's DNA has yet been characterized from any part of Africa except Namibia and the Republic of South Africa. The wildcats of Nigeria are shy, aggressive, and difficult to tame. Those of Uganda are sometimes more tolerant of people, but many do not look like typical wildcats, which in that area have distinctive red-brown backs to their ears and are probably hybrids, their domesticated genes accounting for their friendly behavior. Most of the street cats in the same region show signs of some wild cat in their ancestry, so the distinction between wild cat, street cat, and random bred pet is blurred in many parts of Africa. The wild cats of Zimbabwe, presumably belonging to the southern African subspecies, are a case in point. In the 1960s, naturalist and museum director Ray Smithers kept two hand-reared female wild cats, Goro and Komani, at his home in what was then southern Rhodesia. Both were tame enough to be let out of their pens, though only one at a time, since they would fight whenever they met. Once, Komani disappeared for 4 months, finally reappearing one evening in the beam of Smithers's flashlight. "I called my wife, to whom she is particularly attached, and we sat down while she softly called the cat's name. It must have taken a quarter of an hour before Komani suddenly responded and came to her. The reunion was most moving, Komani going into transports of purring and rubbing herself against my wife's legs." Such behavior is identical to that of a pet cat being reunited with its owner, and the similarities with pet cats did not end there. Both Goro and Komani were affectionate towards Smithers's dogs, rubbing themselves on their legs and curling up in front of the fire with them. Every day they demonstrated their affection for Smithers himself by an effusive display of typical pet cat behavior. "These cats never do anything by halves. For instance, when returning from their day out, they are inclined to become super affectionate. When this happens, one might as well give up what one is doing, for they will walk all over the paper you are writing on, rubbing themselves against your face or hands, or they will jump on your shoulder and insinuate themselves between your face and the book you are reading, roll on it, purring and stretching themselves, sometimes falling off in their enthusiasm, and in general demanding your undivided attention." This may be the behavior of a typical hand-reared Kafri cat, but it is more likely that Goro and Komani, while undoubtedly wild cats in terms of their markings and their hunting ability, nevertheless contain some DNA from interbreeding with pet cats somewhere in their ancestry. The extent of hybridization between wild cats and domestic cats in South Africa and Namibia was recently revealed by DNA sequences from 24 supposed wild cats, 8 of which bore the telltale signs of partial descent from domestic cats. In a survey of zoos in the United States, the UK, and the Republic of South Africa, I found that 10 out of 12 South African wildcats displayed affectionate behavior toward their keepers, and of these, 2 would regularly rub and lick them. This kind of behavior strongly suggests that the latter were hybrids, while those that could not be handled at all were probably genuine wildcats. The 8 that were moderately affectionate might have been either. Hybridization between wild cats and domestic cats is not confined to Africa. In one study, 5 out of 7 wild cats collected in Mongolia carried traces of domestic cat DNA. Only 2 were pure Indian desert cat. In my survey of cats in zoos, I found that out of 12 cats of this subspecies kept in captivity, only 3 had ever spontaneously approached their keepers, and only 1 had ever rubbed on its keeper's leg. From the proportions found in the DNA results, it seems highly likely that all of these were hybrids, even though they all looked like typical Indian desert cats. In the same study of wildcat DNA, almost 1/3 of apparent wildcats sampled in France had some ancestry from domestic pets. With the advent of DNA technology, it is easy to detect hybridization when the local wildcats are genetically distinct from domestic cats, as they are in southern Africa, Central Asia, and Western Europe alike. Defining what is wild and what is a hybrid is much more problematic in places where domestic cats and wildcats are genetically almost identical, as they are around the Fertile Crescent, home of the Arabian wildcat. The Arabian wildcat, Libica, is not only the most similar to domestic cats, it is also probably the nearest living representative of the first Felis silvestris, all the other subspecies having evolved hundreds of thousands of years ago, a consequence of small numbers of animals migrating east, south, or west from the species' origin in the Middle East. The wildcats in Africa north of the Sahara are also probably Libica, but their DNA has not been tested to confirm this. Like all wildcats, the Arabian North African wildcat has a mackerel-striped tabby coat, varying in color from gray to brown, darkest in forest-dwelling animals, palest in those that live on the edges of deserts. It is generally larger and leaner than a typical domestic cat, and both its tail and legs are especially long. Indeed, the front legs are so long that when it sits, its posture is characteristically upright, as depicted by the ancient Egyptians in statues of the cat goddess Bast. While generally nocturnal and therefore rarely seen, it is not particularly rare. Although it is widely claimed that the Arabian wildcat's kittens, if hand-raised, become affectionate toward people, most eyewitness accounts come from Central or Southern Africa, and therefore probably refer to Kafra rather than Libica. The explorer Georg Schweinfurt procured his tame wildcats in what is now southern Sudan, roughly where the ranges of Libica and Kafra merge together, and the most northerly location in Africa to yield reliable accounts of tameable wildcats. Very little is known of the behavior of genuine Libica wildcats, either in the Middle East or Northeast Africa. In the 1990s, conservationist David MacDonald radio-collared 6 wildcats on the Tumama Reserve in central Saudi Arabia. All except 1 kept their distance from human activity. The 6th, however, often wandered into the vicinity of the Pigeon House in Tumama Town and would often be found sleeping with the domestic cats in the yard of one of the houses. On one occasion, he was seen mating with a domestic cat. Apart from showing just how easily hybridization between wild and domestic cats can occur, these and other observations shed little light on whether the wildcats in this part of the world might have been easy to tame thousands of years ago. Tracing the precise geographic origin of the domestic cat is therefore far from easy, for if the archaeological evidence is inconclusive, so is the most recent DNA evidence. The domestic cat's genetic footprint has spread throughout the world, and because it interbreeds so readily, it is now found almost universally in what are, to all outward appearances, wildcats. This is true wherever wildcats have been investigated, from Scotland in the north to Mongolia in the east to the southern tip of Africa. Many of these apparent wildcats have DNA characteristic of domestic cats and must therefore be mainly or entirely descended from domestic cats that have gone feral. Others have a mixture, part wildcat DNA, part domestic. Of 36 wildcats sampled in France, 23 had pure wildcat DNA, 8 were indistinguishable from domestic cats, and 5 were evidently a mixture of the two. The techniques used are sensitive enough only to detect the major contributions to each cat's ancestry. A cat with 1 domestic and 15 wild great-great-grandparents, for example, would probably show up as pure wildcat. Bearing all this in mind, very few entirely pure Felis silvestris wildcats are left anywhere in the world. At least a millennium of contact between wildcat and domestic cat, and 10 times as long in the Middle East, means that there must be at least 1 hybrid in virtually every free-living cat's ancestry. At one extreme, some are domestic pets that have taken to the wild and happen to have the right mackerel coat, such that if they're hit by a vehicle or trapped in some remote area, they are labeled as wildcats. Only a sample of their DNA gives away their true identity. At the other end of the spectrum, some wildcat's ancestry might extend back several hundred generations before a domestic type crops up in their otherwise unblemished family tree. For conservationists anxious to preserve the wildcat in its pristine state, this is an inconvenient truth. In many places in Europe, wildcats are protected animals, and it is an offence to kill one deliberately. Feral cats are not offered this status and may even be treated as vermin. To be clear, a feral cat is a cat that is living wild but is descended from domestic cats. Most are distinguishable from wildcats by their markings, which can be any colour found in domestic cats. How is the law to operate if there is no hard and fast genetic distinction between ferals and wildcats? The best answer is probably the pragmatic one. If a cat looks like a wildcat and behaves like a wildcat, that is, it lives by hunting rather than scavenging, then it probably is a wildcat, or near enough to a wildcat to make little difference. Domestic cats, even those that grow up in the wild and have to fend for themselves, are rarely as skilled at hunting as genuine wildcats. Furthermore, we can now identify the purest wildcats from their DNA, sampled from just a few hairs. Individual cats might therefore be given special protected status in the confidence that they are not just domestic lookalikes. This near-universal hybridity makes it difficult to pinpoint the origin of the domestic cat. Difficult, but not necessarily impossible. Wherever they originated, all the wildcats in that one location should have domestic-type DNA. Following some 4,000 years of coexistence, and presumably interbreeding, each will carry different proportions of wild and domestic genes, but these will be indistinguishable, except for the 15 to 20 genes, so far unidentified, that make cats easier or harder to socialize to people. These must, by definition, be different between domestic and wildcats. Footnote. The estimate of 15 to 20 comes from Carlos Driscoll of the Laboratory of Genomic Diversity at the National Cancer Institute in Frederick, Maryland, who is currently working to pinpoint where these genes lie on the cat's chromosomes and how they may work. End of note. Unfortunately, largely due to the current turmoil in the Middle East and North Africa, it is difficult to obtain sufficient samples of DNA from wildcats in the Fertile Crescent and Northeast Africa to probe this hypothesis fully. The most comprehensive study done so far was able to include samples from only 2 colonies of cats in southern Israel, 3 individuals collected in Saudi Arabia, and 1 in the United Arab Emirates. There were no samples from Lebanon, Jordan, Syria, or Egypt, nor were any included from North Africa. So even the cats from Libya that give Libica its name are still not definitively classified. Until there is more information about the DNA of cats from all these regions, it is impossible to use genetic information to say precisely where domestication began. What the diversity of DNA among today's cats does suggest is that not just one, but several populations of scavenging cats were domesticated. These several domestications may have been more or less contemporary, but it is more likely that they occurred hundreds or even thousands of years apart. We can be reasonably sure that none of those domestications took place in Europe, India, or southern Africa, Otherwise, we would find traces of the DNA of wildcats from those regions in modern domestic cats. But precisely where, in Western Asia and or Northeast Africa, those transformations took place awaits further research. Using the available data, we can posit a convincing scenario, which is that cats were first tamed in one location, probably in the Middle East, for rodent control. The most likely area is therefore that inhabited by the Natufians, but they were not the only early grain-grinding culture in that part of the world. Even earlier, approximately 15,000 years ago in what is now Sudan and southern Egypt, the Kadan culture lived in fixed settlements and harvested wild grains in large quantities. However, some 4,000 years later, following a series of devastating floods in the Nile Valley, they were displaced by hunter-gatherers, meaning that if they had tamed their local wildcats to protect their grain stores, this practice may have died out as their culture was destroyed. During roughly the same period, but further north, in the Nile Valley, the Meshabians are thought to have independently developed some of the technologies that eventually led to agriculture, including food storage and the cultivation of figs. Again, they might feasibly have tamed wildcats to protect their food stores. About 14,000 years ago, some Meshabians left Egypt and moved northeast into the Sinai Desert, where, mixing with the local Kebaran people, they became the Natufians. These migratory Meshabians apparently lived as nomadic hunter-gatherers, but it is possible that even if they had no need or capacity to bring tame cats with them, they nevertheless brought an oral tradition of the usefulness of cats that was absorbed into the Natufian culture. Even if we give the Natufians sole credit for the first domestication of the cat, the genetic diversity of today's cats must have resulted from domestication in more than one location. Wildcats from any one area tend to be genetically similar because they are territorial animals and rarely migrate. Flow of genes between regions is a very slow process. Slow, that is, until more recently, due to humankind's intervention. We know that domestic cats are perfectly able, indeed eager, to mate with members of other subspecies of Felis silvestris, even those which, like the Scottish wildcat, have become genetically distinct following tens of thousands of years of separation from the domestic cat's wild ancestors in the Middle East. For some reason, the offspring of such liaisons, while themselves perfectly capable of reproducing, are rarely incorporated into the pet population nowadays. Rather, those that survive adopt the wildcat lifestyle. Presumably, there is some kind of genetic incompatibility in these hybrids that suppresses the full expression of the genes that would enable them to become socialized to people. Evidently, no such incompatibility existed between the earliest domestic cats and the wild cats around them. As humans began to take cats on their travels, so those cats would have encountered local wild cats belonging to the Libica subspecies and assimilated some of their genes. With no biological barrier to mating, tame females must have been successfully courted by wildcat males. Sometimes, as has been seen recently among cats in Scotland, the resulting kittens would have taken after their father and been unhandleable. Occasionally, however, the kittens would have been easy to tame and stayed with their mother, fusing with the domestic population. This cannot account for all the genetic diversity in today's cats, however, because this process accounts only for new genetic material being introduced from male wildcats. Domestic cats bear the hallmarks of descent from many wildcat males, certainly, but also from about 5 different individual wildcat females, each of which can be located with some certainty in either the Middle East or North Africa. Footnote. Carlos Driscoll and his colleagues have discovered 5 distinct types of mitochondrial DNA in today's domestic cats. Mitochondrial DNA is inherited only through the maternal line. The common maternal ancestor of these 5 cats lived about 130,000 years ago. Over the next 120,000 years, her descendants gradually moved around the Middle East and North Africa, their mitochondrial DNA mutating slightly from time, before a few of them happened to become the ancestors of today's pet cats. End of note. It is possible that each of these five individuals was domesticated separately, each by a different culture in a different location, and that their descendants were subsequently, perhaps hundreds or even thousands of years later, traded among cultures until all the genomes became mixed together. However, such an explanation may give too much agency in this process to humans and not enough to the cats themselves. The ability of those early cats to interbreed with their wild neighbors is what gave them that extra genetic diversity. Every now and then, a tame, semi-domesticated male, lured by the scent and mating calls of a wild female, would have escaped and mated. A few of the resulting offspring could have carried the right genes to be easily tameable. Some of these might have been found and adopted as pets by local women or children, and then raised to mate with other domestic cat males. This need not have happened very often. Only four or five of these, in addition to the original founding female, have their descendants in today's pets. The prehistory of the cat is thus the result of many fortuitous interactions among human intent, human affection for cute animals, and cat biology. It was a far more haphazard process than the domestication of other animals, sheep, goats, cattle, and pigs, that took place at the same time. Domestic dogs of different types were already emerging, showing that people of the time could channel their domestic animals into forms that were more useful and easier to handle than their predecessors. Yet, for thousands of years, the cat remained an essentially wild animal, interbreeding with the local wild populations, such that in many places, the tame and the wild must have formed a continuum rather than the polar opposites they are today. Moreover, wild and domestic cats would have been almost identical in appearance and distinguishable only by their behavior toward people. To earn the tolerance of their human hosts, cats had to be effective hunters. Any cat that allowed mice to flourish in its owner's barn, or perhaps let a snake into the house to bite and poison one of the family, would not have lasted long. Docility, low reactivity, and a dependence on humans to take the lead, prized characteristics in other domesticated animals, would not have done the cat any favors. Nevertheless, the first artistic and written records that we have of cats depict them firmly as part of the family, so they evidently inspired feelings of affection in humans, at least toward the end of this pre-domestication phase. Only now is feline science allowing us to understand how and why this has come to be. The evolution of the cats. Every member of the cat family, from the noble lion to the tiny black-footed cat, can trace its ancestry back to a medium-sized cat-like animal, Pseudylurus, that roamed the steppes of Central Asia some 11 million years ago. Pseudylurus eventually went extinct, but not before unusually low sea levels had allowed it to migrate across what is now the Red Sea into Africa, where it evolved into several medium-sized cats, including those we know today as the caracal and the serval. Other Pseudylurus traveled east across the Bering land bridge into North America, where they eventually evolved into the bobcat, lynx, and puma. Some 2 to 3 million years ago, following the formation of the Panama Isthmus, the first cats crossed into South America. Here they evolved in isolation, forming several species not found anywhere else, including the ocelot and Joffrey's cat. The big cats, lions, tigers, jaguars, and leopards, evolved in Asia and then spread into both Europe and North America, their present-day distributions but a tiny relict of where they used to roam a few million years ago. Remarkably, the distant ancestors of today's domestic cats seem to have evolved in North America about 8 million years ago and then migrated back into Asia some 2 million years later. About 3 million years ago, these began to evolve into the species we know today, including the wildcat, the sand cat and the jungle cat, a separate Asian lineage including Pallas's cat and the fishing cat, also began to diverge at about this time.